We're going to this morning do something that will combine Parshat HaShavua and in Yonei Dioma, and that is we're going to focus for a moment as a segue into Purim. We're going to focus for a moment on the Maftir section that we read, which is for Shabbos Zohar, which of course is the famous Maftir section of Zohar es Asher Asa Lecha Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you, the connection to Purim being that Haman is a descendant. Haman is Haman HaAgagi, descended from the king of Amalek whom Shaul failed to execute. And we read this section not only to introduce Purim, but because we believe that this reading is itself a mitzvah d'oraita, or the fulfillment of a positive commandment, which is that when we read this section, we are fulfilling the mitzvah of remembering what Amalek did to us. So let's take a look at that section for a moment. Zohar es Asher Asa Lecha Amalek, the underlined section beginning at the top of the page. Remember what Amalek did to you. Baderech betzeischem mimitzrayim. On the way as you left Egypt, asher karcha baderech, and this is a very important word. It's a strange word. This verb, karcha, it comes from the word mikre in Pashut Pshat. It comes from the word happenstance, and what it means is, what's the note or what's the characteristic of Amalek? Amalek has no reason to attack you. He just happened upon you on the way. And you weren't crossing into his territory, you weren't threatening him, asher karcha. He happened to meet you, and what's his response? Immediate attempt to exterminate you. And that is the characteristic of Amalek. That, of course, is the characteristic of Haman. Haman gets angry at Mordechai in the Megillah, and what does he decide to do? Kill not just Mordechai, kill all the Jews. That's what makes him Amalek. If he would have said, let me kill Mordechai, he would have been a normal villain. He would have been a bad person. But it takes an Amalek to make the leap from, I'm angry at Mordechai, so what am I going to do? I'm going to kill them all. And that is Amalek. So we're told, Zohar es Asher Asa Lecha Amalek. And then the Torah says at the end, it will be when it will be that Hashem will give you rest and will give you ability to live in peace from all of your other enemies. Eradicate the memory of Amalek from under the skies. Lo tishkach, don't forget. And the question I'm going to raise, and we're not going to answer it right away, we'll answer it at the end of the class, is this seems to be a contradictory commandment. Remember, 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 in order to do what? To forget, all right? Or to erase the memory of Amalek mitachat hashamayim. So I'm remembering in order that there will be no memory of. Well, that, how do I understand that? What is meant by zachor for the purpose, it would seem, of the purpose of mechia or shchicha, forgetting and eradicating? And we're going to come back to that at the end of the class. Let's now travel into, yes, I'm sorry, the karcha mikre. Karcha is the verb of mikre, which means happenstance. Okay, now there is a medrash. Oh, that's the medrash. The medrash says that karcha also can be read, they made it cold, you were burning hot when you came out of Egypt, but the pashut pshat is that it is mikre. It comes from the word mikre. That's medrashic, that's pashut pshat. Okay, now let's go. We're going to dive into Purim for a few moments now and try to understand this holiday, which really is a very, very different festival from all festivals on the Jewish calendar, and we need to understand it. Let's begin by trying to peg Purim historically, and I have a very brief timeline before you, taking you from the patriarchal period to the destruction of the Second Temple. Where in that timeline, this is a quiz, where in that timeline does Purim occur? Between 8 and 9, correct. The Purim occurs between the Babylonian, the end of the Babylonian exile, and during the rebuilding of the Second Temple. So let's understand where we are historically. The 10 tribes have already been dispersed and have disappeared from Jewish history. They're gone, although now we seem to be reclaiming some of them, Baruch Hashem, or they're claiming their own identity somewhere. But 10 tribes are gone. Yehuda and Binyamin in the kingdom of Judah, in the kingdom of Yehuda, continues to exist until Babylonia destroys it, until Babylonia comes and destroys the kingdom of Judah, and in a sequence of events exiles Yehuda into the Babylonian exile, which is the first national exile that we experience once we've become a nation. Let's remember that the exile, that we were in Egypt, that we were not a nation yet. This is the first exile we experience, other than the 10 tribes who are gone. First exile we experience as a nation once we become a nation. Now, this exile is unique. It's different than the exile experienced by the 10 tribes. The 10 tribes, Sancheriv's modus operandi, the mode of operation of the Assyrians was specific. He would conquer a people, he would uproot them from their land and spread them out through his empire and put other people into that land. So that what? So that there would never be a critical amount of people together that could rebel against him. And that's why the 10 tribes disappear, because he spreads them out. And the rabbis say, from the time of Sancheriv, we no longer have or can identify original nations. You can't identify an original Mitzri. You can't identify an original because they're an original member of the 10 tribes, because they've been spread out throughout Sancheriv's empire, and they've disappeared. The Babylonian exile specifically is different. The Babylonian exile, they allow us to stay together. And not only do they allow us to stay together, but they allow us to retain communal structures. The Jewish community in Babylon during the Babylonian exile can live as a Jewish community. And in fact, we have the Gemara talking about Reish Galuta. Who's the Reish Galuta? The Reish Galuta is the head, the exilarch, the head of the Babylonian Jewish community, who's making rules and governing the identity of the Jewish community. So this is an exile. It's a paradigm. It's a paradigm for the exile experience of the Jewish people, because we live in exile and we survive. Nobody else does that. We live in exile and we survive. 70 years or so at the end of the Babylonian exile, what happens? Persia conquers Babylon. And Persia conquers Babylon under the king, Cyrus the Great. Cyrus allows the Jews to return to Israel to rebuild the Second Temple. How many go back? Less than 10%. Why? It's very good in Babylon, right? It's wonderful. I got my cows, I got my horses, I got my land, I got my house, I got my job. Sound familiar? Right? This is the moment when the Babylonian exile switches from an exile of force to an exile of choice. At that moment, Purim appears. At that moment, somewhere in that juncture, Purim appears. And I would argue with you that if we understand the holiday correctly, it is a paradigmatic festival. It is a festival that says, Hashem is turning to Bnei Yisrael and saying to them, you're choosing Golos? I'm going to show you what living in Golos is like. I'm going to show you what this is. I'm going to show you what your choice is bringing. And Therefore, this holiday is in a sense repeated. The events of this holiday are repeated over and over and again in Jewish history. As proof of that, a very interesting historical note, which I've noted for you partially on your sheets. Throughout Jewish history, there's a fascinating phenomenon, and that is individual communities and families. Various individuals and communities who throughout their Golus experience near tragedy or near extermination and end up surviving, they make a holiday. And they call it what? Purim. They call it, and I have a list for you of some of them. This is, there are dozens of them, dozens of them. For example, and I'll just focus on two or three. Purim of Ancona. It's an Italian town. There are actually four Purims of Ancona. Four different communal events where they survived and they created in the 1700s different festivals of Purim. You've got the Purim of the Bandits. This is a great one. This occurs in a city in the Ottoman Empire in 1786 where 5,000 brigands come and threaten the city or threaten the town. The town is saved, the brigands disappear, but afterwards the town people turn around and say, no, whose fault it was? The Jews. And they threaten the Jewish community, and the Ottoman Emperor intercedes and they are saved. What do they create? The Purim of the Bandits. All right? That was the year that I have was 1786. In Hebron, I'll come to you in a minute. In Hebron, there are two Purims. One of them is known as the Purim of the Window. What's the Purim of the Window? Again, this fascinating historical stories. Apparently, again, in the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans are demanding a ransom from the city of Hebron. They don't have the money to pay. One day, somehow, miraculously, a bag of money appears in a window. And no one knows who put it there. They never find out who put it there. It was enough money to pay for the ransom, and they survive. Turn to the next page for a moment, and I'll just pick one of the families. All right? I was attracted by the name of this one. Who was that? I don't remember the... Where was it? In the Ottoman Empire. Somewhere in the Purim Povidil, this is a great one. Purim, the Plum Jam Purim. All right, this occurs in Bohemia in 1731. The daughter of a Jewish bookseller by the name of Brandeis the family Brandeis gives a gift of plum jam to the daughter of a non-Jew. Brandeis is a bookseller, a Jewish bookseller, and what happens is they eat the plum jam and they all get sick. And then the father dies. All right, so all of a sudden now Brandeis is in trouble until a doctor comes along and says it turns out that the father didn't die of plum jam poisoning, he died because he had consumption. Someone said he consumed the plum jam. No, but it was, all right, it was consumption. And therefore, the family is spared, and they survive. And they create a family Purim. So you have family Purims that are occurring in various families over the span of a couple of centuries. So what do we see? What we see is the way in which we view Purim. Purim is not just we are recollecting an event that occurred centuries ago. Purim is we are celebrating a paradigm. We are celebrating or memorializing a paradigm, a frightening paradigm, of what it's like when you're going to live in Golos. And that being the case, every element of this festival is specific to the events of Purim, but also is a paradigm itself for what we will experience across history. And that's what we're going to look at right now. Yes. Do I see any relationship between the Holocaust was at Look, we didn't create a Purim because, unfortunately, the Holocaust we didn't really escape. I mean, that our Purim would be the creation of the State of Israel and our survival. But that's a much greater national event and not specifically this kind of event. Yes. Koresh allows them first. Then there are some issues where they're stopped. And then Darius allows them to continue. And again, whether he is Esther's son or not, it's an interesting question, yet many commentaries say that he's Esther's son. Right. Darius II, yes. Because, again, interesting question, why is Purim, why aren't the other sections, these other events part of Tanakh? Because two things. First of all, Tanakh is closed at a particular time in history. We don't add to that body of book. In addition, I would argue that what we decide to do is we codify the first such event. And we're saying, look at that event. You want to really learn the lesson? Look at what it teaches you, and you'll learn what you can expect, and maybe you should make different decisions. All right, so that being the case, let's look at some of the... Originally, this is a two-part shiur. I thought we had a second one next week. We don't, so I'll try to get in as much as I can in this shiur. All right, so there are a variety of... Today, we're going to look at a variety of phenomena that are specific to the holiday of Purim, but that are so, so familiar to us vis-a-vis our own experience in Golos. Let's begin with the first. The rabbis ask, Esther min HaTorah min Ayin? Right? Strange question. I am now on page 2, section 3, Continuing Diaspora Realities. Section A, God's Hidden Face. The question that the Gemara asks, Esther min HaTorah min Ayin? Now, right away you look at that, you say, that's a strange question. How do I know about Esther from the Torah? How could I possibly know about Esther from the Torah? That Esther appears in history centuries after the Torah is closed. So what did the rabbis answer? An even stranger answer. Esther min HaTorah min Ayin? The Torah says, V'anochi haster astir panai b'yom hazeh. God says, I will hide my face on that day. What do I find? A fascinating connection between the name Esther and God's hiddenness? That's what it's talking about. All right, so are the rabbis just playing word games? The answer obviously is not. Let's understand that this historical juncture is not only important in terms of it being the first point of exile of choice, and we've made this point before, this historical juncture is the beginning of the non-prophetic era of Jewish history, or the national non-prophetic era of Jewish history. At the end of the Babylonian exile, God stops talking directly to us. All the Nevi'im are finished. Yechezkel is a Navi in Golos, in Babel. Yirmiyahu predicted, right, and went into exile as well. There are Haggai, Zechariah, there are a few others, but the prophecy basically, I see somebody's upset. Ezra and Nehemiah, first of all, are not necessarily Nevi'im. They are part of Navi, but they're not. They're the leaders who bring. Ezra is a sofer, Nehemiah is a political leader, right? They don't prophesy the way the others do, and they are also at this juncture. In other words, we're in it. This is all. Even if you claim that they are prophets on some level, this is the end. This is it. After that, there's nobody talking to us. And that being the case, one second. And that the proof of that, of course, is the story of Purim itself. What's missing in the Megillah? Hashem's name. The fact that Hashem's name is missing in the Megillah is not an unrelated phenomenon. It is Hashem is saying to you, okay, guys, you now have to figure it out yourselves. Up until now, I'm telling you things, I'm directly giving you prophetic. There will be miracles, but they're not going to be the kind of miracles that you saw when you left Egypt. You're going to experience things that will appear, and it's going to be your job to understand them. And had Mordechai and Esther looked at the series of events that make the poem story and said, wow, what a bunch of coincidences. My goodness, that would have been the end. We would not have been able to see Purim as the miracle that it was. And every one of these events could be explained. Perhaps Esther was so beautiful she was chosen. Perhaps this, perhaps that. So many things. The king wakes up in the middle of the night. Mordecai happens to hear Bigson and Zeresh. All of these things occur. And yet it's the interpretation of those events as a nes, nistar, Esther. That's what the rabbis are saying. Yes, you had your hand up. It's also the end of that. He's part of the end of the prophetic era. This is it. These are, and what I want you to remember, because we covered this when we were learning the Yosef story, and I have it down for you here on the sheet, is this is why Chazal will constantly compare the story of Purim to the story of Yosef. They will say, I'll show you two places that they do. Well, one is obvious. The first is the third paragraph on the page. Vayasar Paro estabato me'al yodo. All right? Paro takes off his ring, places it on Yosef, gives it to Yosef. Vayobash oso bigdeshe. She dresses him in royal garments. Sentence 43, Vayirkav oso b'merkevet ha-mishneh, asher lo vayikro lefanav avrech. What does he do? He parades him through the streets, and the person before is parading him through the streets is calling him honored nobleman. Sound familiar? All right, you can't make, that can't be any clearer than the scene that happens with Mordechai being paraded through the streets when Haman has to lead him. Next, the rabbis, though, make the connection. In the paragraph right before this, they say that when Yosef has the reunion with his brothers, he gives them all gifts. But to Binyamin, his full brother, he gives five more gifts, right? He ends up giving him five changes of clothing. So the rabbis say, my God, look at what's happening here. The Yosef is falling into the same trap that his father fell into that led him to all of these things happening. You have a father showing favoritism, giving special garments to Yosef. Now Yosef is giving special garments to Binyamin. What's he thinking? And what do they answer? No, Yosef was prophetically, and this is Midrashic, it's not Pashup Shat, Yosef was prophetically alluding to the fact that Binyamin's descendant would one day walk out of the king's chambers clothed in five royal garments. And who's that? Mordechai, right? And you have it before you, right? Vayobash, Bechush, Malchus, Telus, Chur, Karpas, etc., etc. He walks out, therefore, now why are the rabbis going out of their way to, what's the parallel between Yosef and Purim? Parallel between Yosef and Purim is that Jewish history, we've said, begins twice. It begins first in the patriarchal and matriarchal era, as a family, and then it begins again as a nation. It follows the same flow. God talks, he talks, he talks, and then suddenly he's silent in the patriarchal era. When is he suddenly silent? When you get to Yosef. Yosef, God doesn't talk to Yosef. God sends him dreams, but even the dreams are indirect. They're not like Yaakov, his father, who experienced when Betel, where God talks to him. So nobody shows up. God doesn't show up in the pit where he is and doesn't say to him, "Don't worry, I'll be with you," like he said to his father when he was leaving and running away from Esav. You find that suddenly, and what does Yosef do in response to God's silence? Go back and read the text. He brings God into the picture over and over and over again. When they say to him in the jail, "I understand the butler and the baker, we understand that you can interpret dreams," he says, "Not me, God will." When Paro says to him, "You interpret dreams," he says, "Not me, God will." right? Well, and when the brothers are reunited with him and say, my God, you know, we're sorry. What does he say? Don't you worry, God planned the whole thing. So over and over again, Yosef brings God into the world of God's silence. That's why Purim and the Yosef story are connected historically. That God then, after Yosef, we go into Egyptian slavery, we become a nation, God talks again. He talks to Moshe, he talks to Aaron, he talks to the others, he talks to the Nevi'im, until you get to where? Purim. Purim again, God is silent. And you enter the non-prophetic era, the era that we find ourselves in over these thousands of years. The rabbis will say, I'll take in a second, the rabbis will say in all of this, that this creates tremendous problems, but it also creates tremendous challenges which can cause us to rise a level higher. And that's the famous medrash at the bottom of the page, which I showed to you once before, if I remember, where we're now standing at the foot of Har Sinai. Famous medrash. And at the foot of Har Sinai, what does the medrash say? Kafa aleim, it's in the Talmud. Kafa aleim har kigigis, right? At the bottom of the page, bottom of page 2. God uproots the mountain and holds it over the head of the Jews and says, okay, guys, here's your choice. Either you're going to take the Torah and you will survive, or I'm not. You're going to say no, and I'm going to drop the mountain on your head. And then the Medrash goes on to say, but there comes a point in Jewish history where we accept by choice what we accepted by force at Sinai. And when is that? Purim. And when you first learn this Medrash, you say, well, what does Purim have to do with anything? And they say, well, it's because in the Megillah it says, Kimu v'kiblu, we will do and we will accept, which parallels the language at Sinai, Naaseh v'nishma. So therefore, but again, are we playing games? No. What is this Medrash saying? I believe what the Medrash is saying is the following. At Sinai, we had a choice. But the choice was not really a choice. Why? Not because God literally held the mountain over our head, but because we were the people who left Mitzrayim. We saw the 10 plagues. We stood there and we saw Yam Suf part. We went through Yam Suf. We saw the destruction of the Egyptians. We defeat Amalek. We're standing at the foot of Sinai and there's thunder and there's lightning and God is speaking and he says, are you going to take the Torah? What are we going to say? No? All right? There was force of circumstance at Sinai. There was, so as much as we had Bechira, we, on some level, we didn't have Bechira. When does that change? And this is, shows the honesty of Chazal. This shows the brilliant honesty of Chazal. When does that change? That changes at Purim. When we accept a time of God's hiddenness, that which we accepted when God was apparent to us. And therefore, that shows how we... So that is the first element of Purim. Purim reminds us that once we enter this godless existence and once we move past this period of time, we have entered into a time when God is silent and that the miracles that appear will be like the Six-Day War, or will be like the simple truth of having the state of Israel after thousands and thousands of years. Again, anybody who looks at that and doesn't feel that is miraculous on some level doesn't understand history, that we have survived as we have through Golos and are now returning to this land. All right, but that's, I'm going to get off my soapbox. Yes. 100%. In other words, we said last week, Shkoyach, that Kedusha is found in this world by the partnership between man and God, and this is another step in that. God, it's like we say, you take a child, and you hold the child's hand while the child begins to learn to walk. If you never let go of the child's hand, the child will never learn to walk. Somehow you have to allow the child to move, and that's what it would seem on our logic, and if we look at this in the logical level, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying, in the beginning, I'm going to talk to you, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to help you, but at some point, you have to learn to do this yourself. Okay. Prescient means... Explain? Okay. What I'm saying is that prescient means it predicts the future. So Purim is a prescient festival. It's a festival that is setting the paradigm, setting the stage for events that will occur throughout history, not just on Purim. All right, thank you. Okay, next. So let's go on. Section B, page 3. So we've spoken about God's hiddenness. Next, there is a line in the Megillah that we've turned into a song. And by the way, one of the things we should be feeling as we're learning this is the seriousness of this festival. You know, that's one of the problems with Purim if we've turned it into a game. But we'll see why later. But one of the things we need to realize is that this is a very serious festival, that we face near tragedy, and that Tanis Esther is a serious part of Purim. We factor it out because of the unique nature of Purim. We'll see in a while. But the fact is that this is a very, very serious festival. The Megillah uses a phrase. The phrase is Vinahafochu, right? Why are we celebrating at the end of the Megillah? Because this day that was what? Destined to be the day of our extermination? Vinahafochu, it was overturned, upturned, and suddenly we are saved. I am now on page 3 at the top of the page. Page 3, top of the page. The underlined words, Vinahathohu. Right, now, Vinahathohu cuts both ways. What is this story about? It's a story about turbulence. It's a story about vulnerability. It's a story about how one day you are riding high. At the beginning of the Megillah, the rabbis tell us we're celebrating in the palace of Ahasuerus. And one day we're riding high, Vinahafochu. And suddenly Haman rises to power, and you're dealing with that reality, and then suddenly Vinahafochu, it overturns. Now, if anybody needs to find proof of this as a reality in our diaspora existence, open up the newspaper, please. All right, open up the newspaper. Recognize what it means to live in a turbulent time. You don't know what's going to happen. If anybody would have predicted 7 years ago that Donald Trump would be the president of the United States, he would have been on Saturday Night Live. And that would have been it, right? If anybody would predict that the first potential Jewish president would be a guy like Bernie Sanders... Then go ahead. And if anybody would predict that Jared Kushner would be drawing the boundaries of the state of Israel, what kind of world do we live in? All right, these are the events that and God is saying to us, when you are living in a world when you are dependent upon others and your fate is determined by their whims and their ways, go sit and listen to the Human Rights Council and the United Nations. Right? That human rights. Alright? So this is what the kind of world you live in. And that's why one of the reasons we don't say Hallel on Purim. The rabbis have a whole bunch of reasons. The Gemara says one of them is that the Hallel is the Megillah itself, but one of them is you're still living in the realm of Ahasuerus. How can you say poor? How can you say Hallel? You're living in a world where tomorrow, who knows what's going to happen? That has to do with the second shiur that I'm not going to have a chance to give, which is the world of Ahasuerus. Part of each of not only are these events paradigms, but every one of the characters is a paradigm. And Ahasuerus is the uncaring world. Ahasuerus is the king who doesn't care. Do you know what hear what she just said about us having think of Ahasuerus for a minute. When his real evil is finally revealed, is when Esther pleads with him to reverse the edict. He says, I can't. And what will I do instead? Issue a second edict. Go kill them. Right? And then, and what I am... No question about it, but if I'm a king, and I'm ruling over, I'm not talking about it from the Jews did the right thing. Maybe it was, but I am saying, if I'm looking at a king, there are two kinds of kings, at opposite ends of the spectrum. There is a benevolent king who cares about his people, and there is an Ahasuerus, who is basically saying, I'm going to issue an edict, kill each other. Go ahead, have blood run through the streets. I don't give a darn as long as what? As long as it doesn't enter the palace. As long as it stays out there, everything is fine. Haman v'hamelech yashvu lishtos v'yir shushan navocha. Haman and the king, the Megillah paints the picture. They issue the edict, everybody in Shushan's going crazy, not just the Jews. Because what are they issuing? What's the edict they're issuing? That months from now, you can kill your Jewish neighbor. Okay, now what do I do for the next 6 months? Do I borrow sugar from her? Do I say hello? Well, how do I live? How do I live in a society where I know that on this date I'm going to kill you? We didn't, all right? Well, but the point that I'm making is, I'm not saying Hashem, I agreed Hashem orchestrates, but Ahasuerus is a person who has free will. And the free will of this king is to become like the world that watched the Holocaust. In other words, as long as it doesn't touch me, I'm okay, all right? Okay, now, let's go on. So we live in that, and by the way, this kind of turbulence is also mirrored back in Egypt. The rabbis say, Vayakam Melech Chadash, right? So the king, right before we become slaves, it says in the Torah, there was a new king, and the rabbis argue, was it a new king? Was it the same king? And you look at them, you say, what are you arguing about? It says it was a new king, right? So what... Because what the rabbis are saying is it could have been either. Because that's how things go in our exile world. It can be the new king. It can be the same king who tomorrow, you know, I'm wondering, just between you and me, if Trump wins again and the Jews don't vote for Trump, then will he one day wake up and say, you know, to heck with them, right? So... And that possibility between and Kushner aside, that possibility exists because we're living under the kind of realm. I hate to say it, you know, rabbis make jokes about Balabatim, but you make joke about rabbis. We make jokes about Balabatim. But I remember going to my first board meeting as a rabbi, listening. One of the first board meetings I ever went to was in one of my first communities in Potomac, Maryland, where they had a debate. The debate was, how did I get to this? The debate was, we have enough money to buy chairs or tables. We don't have enough money to buy chairs and tables. Fine. There was a chair faction and a table faction. And these people were screaming at each other until one person who was on the table faction decided to change his mind and go to the chair faction. And somebody stood up and said, you're a traitor. And I walked back to my wife. I said, this is their hobby and this is our lives, you know. And this is what happens. So the fact is, to the world, you know, it's our lives. It's our lives. Let's go on. This also explains another phenomenon about Purim, which is probably one, which is certainly one of the strangest, and that is, Chayav Adam Livsumei, a person has to become what? So drunk that he can't tell a difference between Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman. So you look at this, first of all, let's understand that many rabbis have already said, many poskim have said, this is not necessarily literal. You shouldn't get drunk. You can get a little tipsy and go to sleep and not know the difference or whatever. But and this is unfortunately one of those mitzvot that too many of our yeshivot follow too literally, All right? But having said all that, why would it even be said? We as a people don't believe in escapism. We don't believe you're supposed to get drunk and go. Our own is told, don't get drunk when you go into the Mikdash. Why? Not because you only make a mistake, but because other traditions escape into some realm through the use of hallucinogens, and you're supposed to be rooted to the ground. So why does this exist here? Because in this exile world, the line between Mordechai and Haman is not always that clear. Right? In other words, what do I mean by that? You don't know who your friend is, and you don't know who your enemy is. You don't know, and your enemy tomorrow will be your friend, and your friend tomorrow will be what? Well, all of a sudden, we're cozying up to Saudi Arabia. Where did that come from? Right? Thank God, I'd rather cozy up to them than fight them. But are they, all of a sudden, there are good friends? You know, so the line, and you have to be careful. So don't say, oh, it's very clear, Baruch Mordechai or Haman. You're living in a world where it's not so clear. Yes. Right. Thank you. Okay. And that's why, by the way, very well said. What she said is, the very reality of that is it can drive, which is why I believe, by the way, that we have one day, when it comes to Purim, we have one day for Tanis Esther and one day for Purim, because what we're saying in this world, we can't understand the grays, right? It's either got to be, it's black and white. Let's go on. A fragmented nation. All right, what happens here? Let's understand that sometimes our enemies tell the truth. Right? And we have to hear what they're saying. How many times have we said that, you know? No, don't believe Iran. They're just joking. Well, in this case, Haman says something that is very accurate. He turns to Achashverosh and he says, Am echad mefuzar u'mefolad bein ha'amim. He says, they're vulnerable. Why are they vulnerable? Because they're divided. Because they're mefuzar. Because they're not. And the rabbis say that part of our problem was that we were not a cohesive family. We were not a cohesive community. We had split. And as proof of that, there are two phenomena I would point to. One is the fact that this is the only holiday that from the outset is different strokes for different folks. And what I mean by that is, when it comes, and I know about Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golus, but that's not from the outset. That's not built into, you know, the second day of Pesach and the second day of Sukkot is not built in. That comes later. Built into this festival is one day for you and one day for you. And not only is it one day for you and one day for you, you know, walled cities, not walled cities, but the Mishnah says you can observe dependent, the Mishnah says, on your circumstance. If you're a small town and you have to travel into the city on the 11th of Adar, you could conceivably have Purim or parts of Purim on the 11th of Adar because you're worried you're not going to have someone who knows how to read the Megillah for you. So you have various communities potentially celebrating this on different days. Why? Because diaspora communities end up fragmented. And you're going to end up with Ashkenazim and Sfardim and Litvaks and Galicianas. And we don't realize, well, this is so much part of our Judaism that we don't realize how much of this is exile overlay. Two years ago, we spent an overnight in the town of Chitzpin. What's the name of the town? Pikin, okay? And what is, this is a Druze, there's an Israeli town, but there's also the Druze town. We were in the Druze town. What's the Druze town? The Druze town is a place in the Galilee which has had an unbroken Jewish community in it from the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. In other words, what happened was Kohanim and others fled at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. A lot of people don't know about this phenomenon, and found safety in the Galilee, and they settled in the Galilee, which is why the Sanhedrin ends up in the Galilee. And this town could trace an unbroken Jewish presence from that time until the Arab revolts in the early 1900s, and then they came back. There's one Jewish woman still left, and she takes care of the museum in this town. And one of the things that I remember was so profoundly powerful to me is something that it was said in that museum. Somebody said, one quote was that somebody met a Jew from the town, from Pekin, and said, "Who are you? What are you?" And he said, "I'm just a Jew. I'm not Sephardi. I'm not Ashkenazi. I'll add, I'm not Glitziana. I'm not Litvak. I'm just a Jew." Which meant that this individual and his family had missed that entire aspect of our tradition that we consider so fundamental to who we are. Guess what? That's not who. It's an overlay. It's an overlay of Galus. In my shul in Englewood, New Jersey, we have, it's an Ashkenazic shul. I'm still a rabbi emeritus. I can still call it my shul. Don't tell my successor, who's a good friend. All right, but in our shul, it's an Ashkenazi shul, and we have a Sephardic synagogue as part of the shul. And people would go in there and say, "My God, it's so different." And I would say, "Oh, you're not getting it. The miracle is that it's so much the same. The miracle is that you're saying the same Shema, that you're saying basically the same Amidah. The miracle is that you're talking about people that had no contact with each other across the face of history, and now at a time of reuniting, can identify each other as part of the family. That's the miracle." Yes. All right, maybe that's interesting. Very good. She says but it's still a nation. All right, so that's the balance. That's why we survive Galus. But it is an unfortunate or an inevitable reality of Galus that you're also going to grow apart on some level, that you're also going to have different, like I said, different strokes for different folks. Yes and no. Because if you look at the American Jewish community, yes, we reunite in times of difficulty, but the largest percentage of us are disappearing. All right, so you know we unite, but there's a cost. Let's go next. But this also explains, by the way, the mitzvos of Purim. There are four mitzvot that are specific to Purim. What are those four mitzvot? The four mitzvot are reading the Megillah, right? Su'udas Purim, and what else? Shach Manos and Matanos L'Avyonim. All right, if you ever watch Sesame Street, which of those two don't belong? All right, which of these two mitzvot logically are difficult to explain in terms of their relationship to Purim? Mishloach Manos and Matanos L'Avyonim. What does giving tzedakah have to do with Purim? I mean, it's a mitzvah throughout the year. Why is there a particular mitzvah of matanos la'evyonim on Purim? Mishloach manos? I got to give you a hamantashen? I mean, it is the rabbis responding to the fragmentation of the community. The rabbis are saying, when you live in Galus, communal structure is even more important. And therefore, what you need to do, you have to take care of those in need as a community, build your community structure, and you have to build camaraderie with those around you. And therefore, that is the response to Am Echad Mefuzar Umeforad Beinu Amim. Be a community, be a nation, be an Am. And that's why those two mitzvot, I believe, are there. Yes. Well, Because we are, as much as we are home, we are still an exile nation. There's still people, now it's shifting, but we're still a people and we have not completed our destiny. We're not there yet. It's a reminder that this experience still, we are as a nation, we're still so dependent on world, just like exile people living in an exile world. We're still, you know, we're struggling with world opinion, with this, with that. We're not there yet. We're not there yet. It is, and that is a reflection of the reality of Purim. It's a reflection of, that's what happens when you as a people live most of your experience or most of your history in exile. This is what's going to happen. Now, I'm going to get to that in a minute, all right? Because it's even stranger than you think. Yeah, one quick, yeah, go ahead. I'm running out of time. I got two more things to go. I'll top you. I'm sitting in Rome. Looking at the Arch of Titus on an evening where the sun is setting. And I'm in Rome. Yeah. And somebody comes to me and says, where's the Arch of Titus? And I say, she says, well, I'm a Jew from Australia. And I say to her, look at that arch. They thought we were gone. All right? That's our miracle. That you're 100%, that's the balance. But we need to understand there has been a cost. There are the great majority of American Jewry is disappearing. The great majority of European Jewry is disappearing. There are costs to living in this world. And this, let's go on. Two more things. You mentioned that you find it divisive, right? I'm going to make it even stranger for you, okay? Why do we observe Shushan Purim and Purim? What does it trace to? It traces to the Megillah. What happened was, in Shushan, they were granted one extra day to fight the battle. So they didn't celebrate until a day later. So the rabbis made a rule to commemorate that phenomenon that Purim would be celebrated in a walled city like Shushan one day later. All right? And in an unwalled city, the earlier day. However, then the Gemara asks, okay, but we have to define. What's a walled city? And the rabbis say, well, it has to have been walled from the time of Joshua. Then the rabbis ask a question when he conquered the land. But Shushan wasn't walled at the time of Joshua. And the rabbis answer, Shushan's an exception. You hear Purim Torah? Right? What we're doing is we're making a rule because of Shushan, right? And then we're defining it by Yahushua, and we're making Shushan the exception, the thing that created the rule. Ha, it's kind of strange. What are the rabbis saying? When you live in Golos, you still define your holidays by Israel. What is Joshua? The conquest of the land. Your eyes are still on the land. Therefore, you're going to determine when you're going to celebrate that festival. The litmus test will be not your exile experience, even though this is an exile holiday. Your litmus test will be what? Eretz Yisrael. And that's part of why we are still here. Because we've always had our eyes on return. Finally, we end with one last thing. We return to the very first question we asked. Very first, I bet you forgot it. The very first question we asked was, right, why do we remember Amalek? In order seems to be to forget, right? Zohar is Asher, purpose, Timcha, to eradicate the memory. Because, and this is the key to all of our Golos experience, there is a difference between Shechicha and Mechia. Shechicha is you forget. Mechia is you eradicate. When you forget something, the phenomenon is still there. And it's going to come back and rear its ugly head. Right? That's why, don't forget, don't forget, don't forget. That's why now we're re-experiencing anti-Semitism, because we never eradicated it. It was there all along. We tried to forget. The world wants us to forget. Forget the Shoah. Forget it. Move past, move past, move past. Our answer is no. You have to remember. And you have to remember until such time as it's eradicated. And we... And with our help, and therefore it has to be. That's why. That's the purpose of Zechiras Amalek. And therefore, now we can go to this Purim festival. We can recognize some of the serious, serious messages it teaches us about our experience throughout history, our experience today, and we can pray for the time when we will be moche. We will eradicate Amalek and eradicate the desire to still live in exile when we have our homeland. Thank you, everybody.